You are here with Jen and Vanessa.
Hey guys.
And this is our new podcast and first podcast, and we're calling it
Cults, Killers, and Cocktails. Or wait, Killers, Cocktails, and Cults.
Cults, Killers, Cocktails.
Something of the nature.
A great start. So for the cocktail tonight, we are drinking Black and Blue Elixir. It's from West Fork. They have like small batch cocktail mixers that you can pick up. So I picked some up from them this afternoon. They're located near downtown Indianapolis,
which is where we're based.
And it has blackberry blue syrup, citric acid solution, lemon and orange bitters. And of course, I mixed it with whiskey and Vanessa mixed it with vodka.
I am not a whiskey person. So all white liquor for me. And we're having some pretty good snacks over here. We got this fancy cheese and fig jam, which I've never heard of before tonight. Jen always introduces me to great stuff, just like these cocktails. So we are munching and drinking.
All right. So are you ready to get into it?
I think so. Let's do it.
Okay. So just to preface before I get into this, I'm going to be the person that's going to be covering the cults. I've always thought that cults are super interesting, more particularly like why people get into cults and why they like them. So the definition from like the Webster Dictionary of a cult is a relatively small group of people having religious beliefs or practices regarded by others as strange or sinister. An Urban Dictionary cult definition, which of course we always go by Urban Dictionary here, is any organization whose leadership uses mind control on its followers. This applies regardless of the organization's size, beliefs, practices, or where its members live and work. Cults can be religious or secular. Cult leadership consists of one, two, or multiple people. So you might hear certain religious groups that are talked about here in this podcast that you think are not cult-like, and that's fine. We can all agree to disagree, so I'm just going to go ahead and make that known now, just because it's something that can be debated. So we're just going to go with the definition of it's a group of people having a belief that others just might seem weird. So just wanted to give that. So for this week, we are actually going to talk about the family. It's also called the White Brotherhood.
I've never heard of them.
Awesome. So you probably haven't heard of them because they're actually based out of Australia.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
Which if like there's any place I would move, it'd either be New Zealand or Australia, just because I think the people, the atmosphere, it's just amazing. But obviously these people are not as cool. So we're going to get into it. We're just going to start at the beginning on how this started, who the leader was. The leader for the family was actually a woman, and there's not that many female cult leaders. So I thought this would be a great one to start us off. Her name was Anne Hamilton Byrne, and she was actually born as Grace Victoria Edwards. And she was born in December 30th of 1921. She was the leader of the family, obviously, which we'll later discuss, was an Australian doomsday cult that was founded in the 1960s. She's known for being super blonde, beautiful. She loved plastic surgery.
Oh, okay. Well, that makes her beautiful.
So. Right. Yeah, I think it'd be beautiful forever. She was a yoga teacher. I am like, her main belief systems were a blend of Christianity, Hinduism, and like New Age mysticism.
Okay.
She also thought that she was the female reincarnation of Jesus Christ.
Oh,
just like a small thing too.
Just a small little blip in there. Okay. Well, Jesus woman.
Right. Yeah. So whatever. But yeah. So early life, her mom was Florence Holly. Her mom was in mental asylums throughout her entire life.
Okay.
Her mom was diagnosed with schizophrenia.
Oh.
Which, you know, has proven sometimes to be hereditary, but not always.
I was going to say, I feel like that would be passed down.
Right. Yeah. So, but she's ignoring that, so we're going to ignore it, too. Just keep moving on.
No big deal.
Her mom in the 1920s actually was sent to one of her many mental asylums because she set her hair on fire in the street. Yeah.
She didn't die from that?
Nope. She lived. She claimed professly to be a medium, a psychic, and obviously talk to the dead and be able to do all those seances, things like that.
Okay.
So you can tell that Anne was influenced heavily by that. Her dad was Ralph Edwards. He was absent most of the time, so she spent most of her time in a childhood in orphanages, and she was pretty much like the stand-in mom for her other seven siblings.
So she's like a Fiona Gallagher right now. All right, Fiona, I got you.
So as soon as she could, she left the orphanage. She changed her name. So now that she started going by Anne Hamilton. And in 1941, at 20 years old, she married the love of her life, Lionel Harris.
Ooh.
Yeah. And Anne was always known for being someone that's very, very, like, persuasive. And so when they were married, he was actually in the army. And he went AWOL for 8 months because she wanted him by her side.
Oh, hell no. That is so controlling.
Oh, like, yeah.
That is the epiphany of controlling.
I mean, apparently she just knew really how to deal with men, so.
Apparently. I need you to go AWOL and just disappear.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
So when the military police tracked him down, he was living in Victoria with her, and then obviously he got discharged.
He was like, honorably, oh. Right?
Right, yeah, of course. They wanted to adopt, and they wanted to have a family really, really bad. That's something they always wanted in their relationship. But Lionel was killed in a car accident on the way to pick up their baby.
Oh, that's karma right there.
It's horrible.
Oh, that is.
So then after that, she went through a huge depression and she married another guy. His name was Michael Riley. Okay. And he was a South African naval officer. So apparently she just really liked military men.
Apparently. That she was... liked a man in uniform. Baby.
Who doesn't?
I know, right?
And they only lasted for a year. But this is really, really important because Mike Gardner in his free time was also a gardener for a Dr. Rainer Carey Johnson, okay?
Okay.
And so he's the one that kind of fed Anne information about Dr. Rainer, okay? So just keep that in the back of your mind for later.
Gotcha.
Okay, so now we're going to move forward to like the 50s and 60s in Australia. Okay. So in this time period, it's good to know that the culture was just very different. So Australia had a newfound interest in like spiritualism. So it's all about kind of exploring and, you know, just kind of giving in to interests and things of that nature. So Anne actually started teaching yoga in Melbourne in the 1950s. So yoga came over there. Everyone was super into it. She had a huge following in her community. She actually developed a school that regarded like the mental, physical, and the spiritual control of the body. Most of her clients obviously were wealthy middle-aged women.
Okay.
Usually in like the professional, higher middle class or higher class.
Yoga ain't cheap.
Right. No. I mean, I can't even afford yoga. I touch my toes, but that's about it.
Uh-huh.
So she actually was able to get most of these women. And a lot of these women came to her because either their husbands were having affairs and divorce was frowned upon, or their kids were off to college, or they wanted to lose weight, or they just were like looking for something to fill that void in their life.
Gotcha.
So she was teaching at a school called the Gita School. It was with one of her friends, Margaret Sesman, and Anne actually trained Margaret, but then Margaret opened the school. So Anne was teaching there and little things was starting to happen. So for example, at the Gita School, a man disagreed with her. And she cast a spell on him saying that he would be sick.
Yep.
And it wasn't even like a hocus pocus, like, ooh, here's my spell. She just kind of muttered it under her breath and her friend heard her. And then the next day the man was sick. No explanation, anything like that. So at that moment, Sesman breaks ties with her. She was like, I can't deal with this. This is really weird.
I feel like I'd want to be closer to her if she could do that. I'd be like, let me be your best friend.
Right. What's your favorite candy bar? I'm going to bring it over to you just so you can drink it.
Right.
Eat it, whatever.
Yeah.
So Anne is obviously making people afraid of her. She now has a reputation of influence over people's well-being just because one example is enough for me to stay away from someone or to not make them mad at me.
For real, though.
So she used this for power and influence. She obviously was super into yoga, so she meditated daily. She was told to channel a demonic spirit power, to bend people to her will. I don't know if she just said that in order to scare people.
Okay. Now she's getting into the weird, dark stuff, like making somebody sick, making them throw up. That's fine. But now it's like you're going to hell.
Well, I don't understand if you're like Jesus Christ incarnate, how are you channeling demonic spirits?
Oh, that's very true too.
So that's one thing where I'm like, ah! So Anne was a little bit, you know. So anyways, in 1962, Anne ran the doorbell to Dr. Rainer, who we know was her ex-husband's client. He was the gardener. Dr. Rainer.
Right.
So back when she was married to him, he would feed her information about this doctor. So she knew all about his life and everything. Just give you some background on Dr. Rayner. This guy was ridiculously smart. He had a master's degree at the University of Oxford. He had a PhD in physics at the University of London. He lectured in natural philosophy at Queen's University and in Belfast in 1923 and 1927. So he's super respected in his community, has a lot of credentials.
Right. Super, super smart.
Right. But he's like close to retirement. So he started to be interested in spiritualism, just like a lot of the people in Australian culture. He was married and he had two daughters at the time. So backtrack to 1962, Anne rings the doorbell and she knew that he had an upcoming trip with his wife to India. And she rings the doorbell and tells him, your wife's going to be sick on a trip. And you just need to watch over her and make sure that she's okay. She's going to be sick soon.
Okay. Invasion of privacy. But...
Right. But she's trying to do this to, like, prove that she has this special power and, you know.
I guess so.
Which, I went to India last year, and it's really easy to get sick over there, you know. So I'm just going to put that out there. So when they went to India, his wife caught dysentery. And they had to immediately return.
Remind me what dysentery is.
It's like if you eat something and someone makes it with like unclean hands,
okay,
you're going to get sick. And when I went to India, I got sick and I had dysentery.
Oh, that's what you had?
Yeah.
Okay.
And it was horrible, but that's because I drank mango juice without getting a shot beforehand. And I just wanted to chance it.
That's very smart.
But yeah, the juice was amazing. So
no regrets.
So worth it. So worth it. So as soon as they get back to the United States, he seeks out Anne because obviously he's like, this woman is amazing.
Right.
And together then they created the Great White Brotherhood, which is what the organization started out as.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I don't like the name either.
I hate the name.
No, anytime you put white into something, it's not great.
It's not like, cute.
No.
No.
So later that became known as the family. So just to go on with Anne's proof, quote unquote, of her powers, May 4th, 1962, Anne's daughter, Judy, from one of her previous marriages, is 19 years old, and she gets in a car crash.
Aww.
Yeah, she has a double compound fracture at the base of her skull. So it's super serious, definitely could have died. Dr. Rayner, he knew the surgeons that were working with her daughter, and the surgeons were like, it doesn't look good. Like, she's probably going to die, or it's going to be, she's in super bad shape the rest of her life. So Anne, of course, organizes spiritual help and prayers, like, around the clock. And 2 days later, her daughter is sitting up in bed, and a week later left the hospital.
Really?
Yeah. So it seems like a miraculous recovery. And Rayner even said, quote, I think this is the most Christ-like person I have ever met, end quote.
Okay. She's trying to convince me a little bit, too. I mean, like, okay. Need to invite her over for an episode.
Right. So then fast forward 2 years later, Rayner's actually made to retire from his college position because of the rejection of the divinity of Christ. So then he starts focusing on recruiting people for Anne to follow her.
Does he want to train them to like do the things that she's doing or?
No, it's more of like, this is the Messiah. We have to follow her. She knows the only way to happiness and all this.
Yeah, because she's like the woman Jesus, I guess.
Right.
Okay.
So let's go into the actual cult.
Okay. Dig into it.
Rayner's relationships were instrumental in Anne's cult success. And that's because back then, about 5% of people went to college. So all of Rayner's contacts were judges, lawyers, doctors, nurses, everyone that's in quote unquote high society. So he was able to connect those people with Anne. And Anne also had her women in yoga. Again,
the most powerful bitches on the planet.
That's right. The Karens that are focused and ready to do things.
Yeah, judges, lawyers, and people with yoga.
Right. So the yogis have got it.
The yogis.
And Rayner was actually also able to connect her to a nearby psychiatric facility, and it was called New Haven. And this was super important because the doctor over there gave her access to mind-altering drugs. She got a lot of followers that way.
Oh my God. I mean, I would fucking follow her too. I'd be like, whoa, Lady Jesus, let's go.
Right. And you don't know you're on LSD.
No.
Which I don't understand how you would not know you're not on something, but let that be. So later also, she used the psychiatric facility, New Haven, to take cult members there if they didn't want to be in the cult anymore and they would get quote unquote treatments.
So, like, they would be convinced to stay in the cult.
Right. Like, you don't want to leave the cult because you're going to New Haven.
Right.
So it's just another way for her to control people. She was in complete control of all of her members' lives. They'd give her 10% of their income. And that's not uncommon for religions. A lot of religions, I know Christianity, for example, a lot of people give 10%.
Yeah.
It's a tithe. So she'd make all of her members tithe. She would obviously make them do yoga. I mean, you kind of can't get away from yoga if she's a yoga teacher.
I mean, that would be the fittest cult on this planet, though. Like, right? I just want to be like a bunch of fat people. It would just be like super skinny and shape people.
You would have to attend ceremonies, her sermons once a week, and you'd also have to pledge total obedience.
Okay, well, I can see that.
One of the child survivors from this cult, David Whitaker, he said, there was only one rule. Do absolutely everything she said. That included what to think, what to wear, what to eat, who to marry, who not to marry, total obedience.
Okay, this is getting away from the yoga a little bit. Like, I thought that we were just doing yoga, having a good time,
following Lady
Jesus, but now you're telling me what to eat. I'm taking a little bit of offense to that.
Right. She would literally tell women to leave her husbands.
Oh! Wait. So if you didn't like somebody just because whatever, she would just be like, leave.
I mean, look, if you're one of her people in her yoga class, you're unhappy with your marriage, you know your husband's cheating with a secretary.
Oh, I guess that's true.
And she's like, well, then leave him. Pledge allegiance to me. Divorce was not highly accepted back then. So then they would feel like they need a community or someone to back them up. And, you know, she provided that relief.
Okay.
So she was able to get a lot of people that way. She also had the belief system that she would cancel the karma for members. And this happened during the initiation ceremony. And it only happened if you did every single thing that she told you to. And kind of what that meant was that she believed, because she mixed Hinduism, Christianity, all this New Age stuff, that you were reincarnated. She was reincarnated to be Jesus Christ in her belief. So she was thinking that if you pledge allegiance to her, this is going to be your last life. So then you can like finally find peace after this life. You won't have to keep being reincarnated, and you're not going to have to pay for the past sins of all your past lives.
Oh.
So she'll cancel the karma, so then you only pay for the sins that you actually lived in this life, not your past Egyptian life or, you know, whoever you were back then.
Oh, gotcha.
So a lot of people kind of fed into that. Said that she had the secret to eternal happiness and fulfillment in the life. A lot of the members met at a lodge several times a week. They would take LSD. actually, Rainer was one of the LSD, but it was specifically interests of scientific research.
But he knew that it was LSD.
Okay. Yeah, he knew. But other members, they knew they were getting, the adults at least, knew they were being administered LSD. It was just part of the opening yourself up.
Oh, okay.
So they would do the weekly meditation sessions, sermons, and she would actually sit on a purple throne when she was doing these sermons.
I mean, that's pretty bougie.
Purple's the color of royalty, so yeah.
I totally
agree.
Yeah.
In 1968, she married Bill Byrne. He's also rich.
Oh, okay.
So that's important to know.
Okay, and so he's rich.
At the time she actually met him, he was married and had two kids.
Ew, she's a homewrecker.
She's a homewrecker that ended up taking his wife to New Haven. And his wife was committed.
Shut up.
No. She liked Bill. She got Bill.
Oh, my God.
This woman knows what she wants and she goes for it.
Man, she don't mess around. Mm. She's like, let me just get your wife in New Haven real quick.
Right?
God.
Babe, I got this. I'll fix this for us.
Yeah.
Crazy. So now we're in the 1970s. While taking LSD, she has a trip and Anne has a vision that she needs to collect kids from birth because there's going to be a war or a natural disaster.
Okay.
And it's coming up soon. These kids are going to re-educate the world.
All right.
In her vision, UFOs would come down. Yeah, aliens come into this. It's crazy. And the kids would get inside. They would leave Earth, and the disaster would happen to Earth. And then later they'd come back down and repopulate the Earth, teach everyone how to act, pretty much be like the leaders.
Isn't there like a movie about that? I don't know what it's called or anything, but I feel like that sounds like a Hollywood movie.
It sounds like, I mean, this literally sounds like a Hollywood movie. I'm surprised they haven't made one out.
I know.
There's a couple documentaries, but that's it. So in the 1970s, she starts racking up these kids. She had over 28 kids in her possession in 21 years. And some of them were the group members' kids, where the adults would literally just give them their kids because they believed that she was the Messiah. Other ones were stolen.
She stole, like, her people's kids?
Yeah, she stole not her people's, but random kids from random people. So, for example, she had this network of professionals. She had doctors, social workers, lawyers, nurses. So there would be a single mom that comes in, dad has died, you know, about to give birth. She would give birth. They would smother the mom. The lawyers would mess up the documents to make sure it looked legit, that it was actually Anne's kid. The social worker would give the kid over to her. There was a whole network, and it wasn't always murder. Sometimes they would just take kids away. Sometimes they would fudge adoptions. But either way, she illegally... So Anne would come and go as she pleased with Bill. They actually had a pretty big fortune. So they would travel overseas. And once she had her family that she's always kind of wanted, she didn't seem to want to come around as much. So she had aunties and uncles is what they called them. But it was sect members that were very, very devoted that would go and watch over the kids 24/7.
So like maid nannies, I guess.
Yeah. And the parents that gave up their kids in the cults never knew what was going on with the kids.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
They probably didn't care, really. No. They devoted their life to this lady.
Right. And then sometimes they would have, like, one of their weekly meetings, and the kids would come in and sing a song, and they'd be gone. And that's, like, the most you would see your kid.
Oh, good. Yeah. Good. Yeah. That's a lot of custody right there.
Right. The kids lived in a place called Eden, and it was registered as a school. Anne was very smart, and she had it registered as a school, so then they didn't have a lot of contact with the outside world. They were always with an adult. They weren't allowed to interact with anybody. If they saw anybody, they had rehearsed speeches on like what to say, what to do, so they didn't bring attention. Anne and Bill obviously traveled a lot, but the kids had a routine every day, and it was always the same. But the aunties and uncles would change random things sometimes in the routine in order to beat and punish the kids.
Aw.
Yeah, so they'd wake up at like 5:30, do yoga and meditation. They had school 7 days a week.
Oh, they don't even get a break?
No. Every day they had school. They would have lunch, and it was always veggies. They were on a vegetarian diet.
Okay, which, that's just torture.
Right. I couldn't do it, but more power to you. They would shower, have dinner, vegetables again, and then they would do meditation, yoga, and sleep.
Oh, my God. That sounds like hell.
Yeah, that's their life.
Are they in prison, or?
It sounds like prison.
It really does.
And for the punishments, which happened very often, they would starve the kids. One of the kids actually said they had no food for over a week. All the cupboards were locked. One of the kids, when eventually people found them, was so malnourished that they had dwarfism. So their growth was stunted. And when they were back in society, they grew 2 centimeters in 1 week.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So that can show you, like, how much that they were treating these kids just inhumane. It's ridiculous. They would put their heads underwater. Yeah, to simulate drowning as a punishment. The kids were on tranquilizers a lot of the time, so they were highly sedated, and they were not given medical treatment.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So at 14, kids had this ceremony, and it was called the clearing, and they were given LSD. They would trip for days, and guess who they would see when they were near the end of their trip?
The Lady Jesus.
Lady Jesus would come and be at the end of their trip.
Oh, my God.
So she used this to also manipulate them, to them thinking, you know, they're in this right place. They have this calling. It's great. And a lot of the kids were unhappy. But at the same time, like, you don't really know you're starving when you've had the same thing your entire life. They have nothing to compare it to.
They're so used to it.
Yeah. So in 1987... Sarah Hamilton Byrne, she was actually expelled by Anne. She was told to leave the compound, and it was because towards the end of the 80s, she was allowed to make more friends outside of the compound, and one night she brought a couple friends there.
Was she not allowed to do that?
No, outsiders are not allowed.
Oh, my God.
So Anne gets super mad, and she expels her. So she goes back to her friend's house, who she's met, and... finally, the parents do something right, and they tell them to call police.
I mean, my thing is, like, first you steal her husband, and then you kick her out of the compound, which she's known for how many years now?
Like, well, Sarah was, like, a little kid in the compound.
Oh, okay, okay, okay.
So she grew up in the compound. She made a friend, and then that was outside of the compound. Brought the friend over to be like, hey, come to my house after school, you know, whatever, like, kids do.
Oh, I was thinking that was her. The guy's
no, wife. May's still chilling.
Gotcha, gotcha, yeah. Gotcha. Okay. So, but still, I mean, that's shitty.
It's ridiculous. The police end up coming over. They raid the house. They put the kids in foster care, and then they start an investigation.
Hell yeah. Yes. Here we go.
There's some justice. There's
now
some justice.
It's heating up.
Anne and Bill are on the run. And finally, in 1993, they're arrested.
So when did this start? Like, remind me when this whole thing started.
I mean, the whole movement kind of started in the 60s, ends in 87.
So it's going on for almost 30 years.
Yeah, nobody's paying attention to anything. It's ridiculous. So they don't have enough evidence to bring any child abuse allegations. So actually, when they go to court, they're only fined $5,000 each for falsifying birth documents. That's it. They can't prove anything else. They don't have enough evidence. And all these people are well-connected. So it's really
hard. It's all the powerful people.
It really is. The judge didn't give them any jail time due to their age, health, and because they actually spent 3 months in American prison while they were awaiting trial.
Okay. So that, like, takes off your sentence altogether.
Mm-hmm. And so no justice was actually really done.
Oh, no.
Tons of former cult members, as they've tried to integrate into society, couldn't deal with the depression and have actually killed themselves. There's still a lot of survivors, but people have not known how to deal with this. Bill died in 2001 from kidney failure. And like we said before, he was super rich.
Uh-huh.
He left his entire estate to Anne.
God damn it.
Nothing to his four kids.
God damn it.
And then Anne was diagnosed with dementia in 2007.
Well, no shit. She should have been diagnosed with that in like 1980.
Yeah. And she died in a nursing home at age 97 in 2019.
Why did she? 2019?
Yeah.
Oh my God. She just died.
Mm-hmm. And while she had dementia, two of her disciples, there's some people that still believe in this stuff today, were given like power of attorney over all of her affairs. And they put her money in a creature's, like, for all foundation, so none of these kids that were mistreated and technically had rights, because they all had her last name, to this mass fortune.
Yeah.
They can't get anything.
What a bitch. Yeah. God, she was a bitch to the grave.
And at one point, she was worth $10 million.
Oh, my God.
And that was back then, so can you imagine how much that's worth now?
I don't even know how much that would be worth now.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Man. Jen, that was a good one.
So, thanks. So, yeah, that's my review of The Family, and it is my first cult that I have researched, and I'm excited to keep researching more in the future and providing updates. At the very end of the episode, we are going to list all of our sources, all of the documentaries, podcasts we've listened to, all of the websites and testimonies that we've got in our research. So if you're wanting more information on how actually we did receive the information, just tune in at the end of the episode.
Okay, is it my turn?
Yes.
All right, let's do this. So I'm going to be covering serial killers. I got introduced to the podcast world by Jen, and I just kept listening to killers, and then, like, I thought it was interesting, like, more when they have more murders or they are serial killers. Like, I just want to understand how their brain works. So I will be doing serial killers for this podcast. And the person I chose first, and I really hope you haven't heard of him, it's Donald Gaskins.
I have not heard of him.
Oh, thank God. Okay. So here we go. Donald Pee Wee Gaskins.
Pee Wee?
Pee Wee.
All right. Okay.
You're about to find out on the next bullet point why he was named Pee Wee. He was a male that was 5 feet 5 inches tall.
Poor guy.
And he was 130 pounds, but, like, he's in better shape than I am.
Well, so. Yeah, I'm, like, 180, so, like, I can't even, I'm 5'5", so.
Like, I'm 5'2", and I weigh more than 130, so I'm like, eh, you're a good guy. But his date of birth was March 13th, 1933, and as you can suspect, he was bullied all around. He was bullied at home by his mom and grandma for not listening. He was bullied by his mom's many boyfriends and stepfathers because she was, like, mildly into prostitution. She wasn't a huge prostitute. But
just, like a mild one.
She just, like, dipped her toe in the water once in a while. So he was also bullied at school for his small figure, hence the name Pee Wee. Clearly, growing up wasn't easy, and it did not turn positive. He quit school at 11 years old.
Oh, my gosh.
In the fifth grade. He started to work on cars at a garage, which
honestly baffles me because I can't even change my oil.
Yeah.
And I'm 29 years old.
But I feel like if you're that type of guy, you like want to prove your manliness. So like cars are the automatic man card, right?
I guess. I mean, he's starting early at 11 years old.
Yeah.
He met two kids there and their names were Danny and Marsh. So two other kids were working in this car shop. And
do they have child labor laws?
I don't even know. But they decided to be like the Powerpuff Girls and nicknamed their new friend trio the Trouble Trio.
All right, Triple Trouble, I guess.
Triple Trouble, whatever. But they definitely picked a suitable name because they would rob homes, have prostitutes, and rape people.
Awesome.
So I'm just telling you right now, kind of like a preface, this is a wild roller coaster ride. Like, I know that we said we were going to be subtle, like, for the first episode, but I don't think there's any kind of subtle with serial killers.
I'm here for it. Let's
like,
do it.
He just goes up and down. So, here we go. So, they broke up. Their trio broke up because they all got caught gang raping Marsha's little sister.
What?
Yeah. They're disgusting pieces of shit, and they should rot in hell. But so after their trio broke up, Donald decided to go solo and said, you know, fuck it, and started robbing places by himself.
All right. Okay.
In the midst of his robbing spree, he decided to rob a female acquaintance slash friend. She saw him and she did the damn thing and defended herself.
Good.
And she struck him with an axe.
An axe?
An axe.
So she just had an axe with her.
Apparently, you know, in the 1930s, they just had axes laying around.
I need to update what's in my car, I guess. Okay. I don't even have pepper spray.
Forget mace. Let me get an axe.
Axe.
So apparently she didn't hit him in the sweet spot because he struck her back. But he's not a serial killer yet because she survives and was able to identify him.
Well, that's his first problem. He has a victim that he left.
Okay. So Pee-wee got charged with assault with intent to kill. He got sentenced to the South Carolina Industrial School for Boys. And I looked this up because I was like, I feel like this is just like a private school. It's more like a juvie. He was sentenced until he was 18. So they weren't playing with his first time offense.
I mean, at least it's a juvie that kind of looks good on your resume. It's not a juvenile detention center.
Yeah, you like know? He's ever going to get a good job from this.
I was
in
the school for boys. It wasn't jail, I promise.
It wasn't juvie. Now let's just look past that. It was more like a trade school. He was taught to farm during his time there. But on the second day of being admitted, he was bullied for being a peewee, for being small, and he was gang raped in the shower by a lot of other prisoner boys.
Oh my gosh.
Day two.
That's insane.
He decided to join a traveling circus, I guess for being peewee. I don't know like what he did in the circus, but he met and married a 13-year-old girl, which I don't even know how that's possible. I don't know the laws back in the 1930s.
But back then, wasn't it more of like older men married younger women at the time? But 13 is
about that. Apparently, he got out of that phase because he quit and returned to the academy to finish his sentence.
Really? Willingly?
He just went back. Yeah. He just went back to the academy. I was like, I'll just finish my sentence, whatever.
Okay.
So I was like, okay. Cool. When he got out at 18, he decided to put those trade skills to use and worked at a tobacco farm.
All right.
Or I guess like multiple tobacco farms.
Good for him.
Alas, trade school has taught him farming, but did not teach him to stop being a criminal. So what he would do on these tobacco farms is he would steal tobacco and then sell it himself. And then he would set fire to the farms afterwards to cover up his theft.
Wow, that's smart.
I'm like, that's kind of smart.
It's smart. It's bad, but it's smart.
Mm-hmm. One day, one of his traveling tobacco farm boss's daughter, say that three times in a row. One of his boss's daughters got suspicious of his scheming ways. She called him out on it and he panicked and he split her head open with a hammer.
What else are you going to do when you panic?
I know, right? She survives again, which good for you, girl. But he's not having any luck with murdering people. Yeah. So he got sentenced to 5 years for assault with a deadly weapon, attempted murder, and arson. And I feel like that should have been more. But
yeah. Whatever. I always feel like the first time they always go light. But
yeah. But I mean, he's just spent his last like 6 years in juvie, kind of, because he escaped. But and then he only got 5 years for trying to kill somebody. But you know. Whatever. So basically when he got caught, he's thinking, shit, I don't want to go back to prison and get raped and bullied. So within the first few days of prison, Pee-wee murders the most quote-unquote powerful man so that the other inmates know not to fuck with him.
How did he murder him?
He just killed him.
Oh.
Like, they just got in, like, a prison fight and he killed him.
Gotcha. Okay.
So now he's the new power man. And he only got 6 months of solitary confinement for this and 3 extra years added on to his sentence.
I mean, it is better than getting raped.
I mean, honestly, yeah. And I feel like the prison system didn't like the guy that he murdered that much because you're only getting 3 years added onto your sentence.
Yeah, I mean, murder is never the option that you should go for.
It's never the option you should go for.
But I can see why he thought it might have been a good idea.
Yeah. So, remember that circus wife? In 1955, she just files for divorce.
I would, too.
I would, too, because all of his crimes relating to women. He's 22 years old at the time. He started working as a traveling minister.
What?
So that it would be hard for police to capture him because he's traveling all of these places and robbing them. And so he didn't want to, like, get caught.
Don't you have to have, like, a good background? Or I guess they don't really check that for ministry, but
I feel like he might have started his own business. I don't know.
May have lied.
Maybe.
Just maybe.
Maybe. Cringy. Here we go. So 1 year later, he decided to rape a 12-year-old girl at a robbery. And he escaped to North Carolina in a stolen car to get away from the whole area. And then he meets and marries a 17-year-old girl.
What's with the teenagers?
Girl, just, I don't even know, but he's 29 at the time.
That's disgusting.
Like, he's basically our age. And, like, can you imagine, like, being with a 17-year-old?
Oh, no. I even hate when guys are like, the half your age plus seven. Like, no. That's disgusting.
Yeah. Yeah, he meets and marries her, and hashtag karma, she turns him in for statutory rape.
Good.
So I'm not sure, like, if, you know, she turned him in for rape of her because she's technically a minor, or if it was the 12-year-old, like, they were having pillow talk one night.
Right.
And he was like, hey, I raped a 12-year-old. Like, that's not cute. So I don't know, like, why she turned him in, but it was for statutory rape. But he got 6 years in prison for it. During this time, he was escaping and being caught. And he actually pulled a Ted Bundy and jumped out of a second-story courthouse window. And he would live in the woods during his free time. And he ate snakes and, like, drank water, but he would boil the water before he drank it so he didn't get, like, any kind of diseases or anything or any sickness. And he would live out there. So he was, like, a natural woodsman.
Interesting. Okay.
So he would also, like, when he was escaped, he would taunt cops by writing on dirty windshields, Pee-wee was here. So he was just being an asshole about it.
Right. He has a big head.
Yeah. So finally, he got released in 1968, and he vowed to never return again, but spoiler alert, he does. So now he's 35 years old, and now it's been a year, 1 year after being released from prison, he picks up a female hitchhiker. And he, you know, he wants to try his luck with the ladies, and he hits on her, and she literally laughs at him.
Oh, no. That's, like, the worst thing you could do if you're a hitchhiker.
Like, laugh in his face. I would have, like, tried to, like, hold back a little bit. Like,
right. Or just been like, I'm sorry, I'm married, or I have a boyfriend.
Yeah.
Just anything. That's the easiest one in the book.
But she didn't get that memo. She laughed in his face. And that was the snapping point. In consequence, Pee-wee beat her, raped her, sodomized her, tortured her, and finally murdered her.
Okay.
He went to a swamp to sink her weighted body until she drowned. And he had an epiphany, you might say, and realized that this solved his bothersome feelings of being bullied throughout his life.
Women? Like?
Like, just killing people.
Okay.
So he wanted to continue, so he did just that. He would drive up and down the highway, picking up hitchhikers, and eventually murder them. He loved torturing his victims. He would keep his victim alive for days. And he would sometimes cannibalize their body parts.
What?
Making the victim watch, or even sometimes join in.
So he's like the OG Jeffrey Dahmer.
OG, but I don't think Jeffrey Dahmer ever, like, made people, like, eat their own body parts.
No, that's ridiculous, like, and sadistic. I can't.
That's like chopping off, like, your freaking index finger and be like, eat this. Like, I think I would just die right there. Or yeah. Pass out at least.
How is this guy not more famous?
I don't know. That's my thing. Okay, so this is another weird thing about him. So he drove a hearse around town with a bumper sticker that said, "We haul anything, living or dead." And I don't know if he picked up the victims in the Hearst, and I'm not victim blaming at all, because it's never the victim's fault. But you have to be pretty fucking brave to get in a Hearst for hitchhiking.
I would never get in a Hearst.
I would literally be like, nah.
I'll take the next one.
It's fine. I'll just walk. It's fine. So his highway murders of hitchhikers were, quote unquote, weekend recreation. And it is thought that he was up to his 80th victim in 1975.
80?
Yeah, girl. He's 41, and at this time he's been released from prison for 6 years. And so 5 years of murder, because he didn't kill his first victim until a year out of prison. So I did math, and that is one person every 3 to 4 weeks that he would kill.
That's ridiculous.
So he had his highway murders, which were the weekend ones, again. But his personal friends were serious murders, quote unquote. And he did have a few of those. He killed his niece and her friend. They were both 15 years old. And he raped and drowned them in a swamp. His niece's name was Janice Kirby, and her friend's name was Patricia Alsbrook. And the parents thought that she just, like, ran away. And I just can't imagine, like, being somebody's, like, I guess for me, sister, or I guess his brother. And, like, there's a search party out looking for her and just being like, oh, I don't know what happened to her. And, like, knowing in the back of your head that you raped and killed her.
Yeah.
He did that. And he also killed one of his only friends in town. Her name was Doreen Dempsey. She was pregnant, and she had a 2-year-old daughter. He raped and killed both of them. And he drowned them both in a swamp, which was called Alligator Landing. And when I say he raped and killed both of them, he literally raped and killed both of them. He raped the 2-year-old. Quote, he couldn't resist raping the baby.
I hate this guy.
And if you didn't hate him enough, the reason that he raped the baby is because she was half black and he didn't believe in that. So he was a racist piece of shit.
Okay. All right.
Like, I don't know how I haven't heard of this guy before.
Yeah, that's what I keep thinking.
He's literally the worst. Third serious murder. His name was Dylan Bellamy and his half-brother, Johnny Knight. I think Dennis was 25, and I think Johnny was, like, 15. But they were in the middle of, like, a car theft ring in their town because, you know, Donald can't ever stay out of crime. They were in the woods, and they were looking up at an oak tree. And they wanted to see how they could, like, throw a chain over a branch to get a car engine out.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how exactly that would work, like a pulley system or something like that.
That's the only thing I can think of.
So they were trying to dispose of, like, the car motors or something, or just get them out to sell them. But Donald shot Dennis in the back of the neck while they were out there. And then Johnny started to run, and then he shot Johnny. And the reason is that he thought that they were going to rat him out, which I don't understand, because if they rat him out, they're going to be ratted out.
Right, yeah.
So, whatever. To the fun recreational highway murders, there were 3 people whose van broke down on the side of the road. Donald went up to him. He was like, hey, guys, I'll help you. Like, I'll drive you to a gas station, whatever. And shocking, he murdered them all instead. But at this point, he was like, shit, what am I going to do with the van? Because he's used to picking up hitchhikers.
Right, yeah. So there's no how to dispose of the evidence.
Yeah, so there's no baggage with that. So he called his ex-con buddy, Walter Neely, who owned a garage. And I don't know, like, if he met him from his teens, but he was just an ex-con buddy. But Walter repainted the van, and then he sold it. And then Walter was basically like, bro, you kill people? Let's make money off this.
No, Walter, bad.
Bad Walter, you're bad influence. Pee-wee was hired as a hitman for a man named Silas Yates, which was an ex-boyfriend of a lady named Suzanne Kipper. And he was paid $1,500 for this hitman job. And that is $7,250 in today's money.
Okay.
Which
that's,
I'm like,
not enough money, but what
that
else?
That is not worth it. Like, even, like, a good paying job, like, you can make that in, like, a couple of months or something like
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, $7,250 to kill someone in today's time. Walter helped Pee-wee bury Silas in a quote-unquote private cemetery. So back to the personal murders. Kim Gelkins. She was a 13-year-old fifth grader, and I think she was held back. I'm not sure, but all my sources said that she was 13 and she was in fifth grade. So her mom died the previous summer, and she was lonely. And one day she didn't show up for school, so her teacher, Miss Dunham, reported her missing. And her teacher recalls her writing an essay about Adonna Gaskins and how she admired him. Police went to Donald, because it's a small town, so Donna, Donald. And police questioned him, and he said, don't worry about her. She probably ran away. And police were like, you're the town weirdo who drives a hearse, so we don't trust you.
Right.
So police had seen Donald and Walter running around together, so they decided to question Walter. And Walter was like, let's be best friends, and you don't charge me with anything. And so Walter showed the police where he had helped Gaskins bury Silas Yates, which was the hitman victim.
All right, Walter, okay.
Right, good for you, baby. Police then went to Donald's house to search for Kim Gelkins, and they found her clothes at his house. So they arrested him for contributing to the delinquency of a minor. Well, it is when a person fails to act in a way that causes a minor to engage in illegal or delinquent habitual behavior.
Okay.
So basically, like, if you're encouraging, like, a kid to skip school, that's what it is. Meanwhile, back at the graveyard, police found 6 bodies within 25 feet of each other. There were 3 shallow graves and 2 bodies per grave. One was Dennis and half-brother Johnny, which were the car thief people.
Right.
One was Patricia and her child. And one was Janice and her friend, which was his niece.
Right.
And Kim was not in the 6 bodies.
Interesting. Okay.
So, but later he confessed to raping and strangling her because she denied sexual advances. Which I'm like, if you wrote an essay about, like, how much you admired him, like, I would be heartbroken that my idol, like, tried to rape me.
Right.
Or did rape me and then killed me, you know. Gaskins ended up confessing to the murder of Dennis and Johnny. Gaskins and Neely both got charged with murder. And Gaskins later confessed to 7 more murders, 8 total, to avoid the death penalty. So in May of 1976, Gaskins was convicted on 8 counts of first-degree murder. And he was sentenced to the electric chair. So his plan of confessing to all these murders did not work for him. In 1977, the U.S. said that the death sentence was unconstitutional. So he got 7 life sentences instead. Next year, in 1978, the U.S. said, just kidding, guys, and made it okay again.
Poor guy.
Since the sentence had already been changed, he would have just had life in prison. So, like, he got off the death penalty, and he was just like, okay, well, it's just life in prison now. But he fucked up, just like good old Donnie does. So, in 1982, he's serving his life sentence for all these murders. Mm-hmm. Like, he's fine, doing his thing. And then he was hired as a hitman in prison.
Of course he was.
And he was hired to kill a man named Rudolph Tyner. And the family must have wanted him, like, dead at that moment because he was already on death row. Like, Rudolph was already on death row.
Yeah, just waited out.
Exactly. So, my thing is, like, I don't understand why Donald would have, like, taken the job as a hitman because he already got his wish. He's not going to get out of prison. But, like, hiring as a hitman, like, are you going to put more money in commissary? Like,
yeah, there's, you can't snacks? Get anything. There's no way.
Like, what do you want? So what Donald did was he befriended Rudolph and he gave him poisoned food and weed because he was trying to kill him. And the poison didn't kill him. And he got just really sick by it. But, I mean, he was still alive. So Donald came up with the plan B and he said, quote, I came up with something. He can't be making no damn sick of it. I need 1 electric cup and as much of a stick of damn dynamite you can get. I'll take the damn radio and rig it into a bomb, and when he plugs the son of a bitch in, it will blow him into hell. Just listen for the bang. So basically what they were doing, like, this was in the 80s. So you know, like, that telephone game?
Yeah.
Where you hold the cup up to your ear and there's, like, a wire attaching to it?
Mm-hmm.
So that's what they were going to do with each other. They were going to hold it up, and then he was going to blow his ear off, basically, and, like, blow his brain up. And it worked, but he got caught. Why do you think he got caught?
Right.
Because that quote came from a phone recorded jail line.
Why do people always talk on the phone in prison when they don't need to be recorded?
I'm just like, how would you not? Like, he's talking to the family that hired him as a hitman. And he's telling him his plan and, like, what he's going to do and everything. Like, dumbass. So he got sentenced to death again by the electric chair. And leading up to the execution, he started confessing to fake murders out of desperation. Like, to not get, I guess, executed. But the thing is, you already had this.
Yeah, trying to plead for more time, probably.
You had it, bro. Like, so the day of the execution, he tried to cut his wrist to kill himself, which, fuck you, you're a pussy. And it didn't work. And so, do you remember with Ted Bundy, there was, like, a big old crowd outside the jail?
Right.
So there was a crowd outside this one, too. And they had a chant going over and over again. It said, fire, fire, burn like a chicken. People of his kind are ripe for the picking. Shave his head and apply the gel. Pull the lever and send him to hell.
That's an impressive chant. That's a lot to memorize, especially with a big crowd.
But I was watching a video over there, and they kept saying over and over again. I was like, God, you guys are good.
Yeah, that's an impressive like crowd. I will say that.
Right. So at 1:04 a.m., the chair started. At 1:06 a.m., the chair stopped. He was pronounced dead on September 6th, 1991 at 1:10 a.m., which I don't know how lethal injections work right now, but I feel like that's super late. Like, that's past my bedtime.
Yeah.
They start at 1 in the morning.
And you never know. Maybe they switch it up so people don't know when they're actually going to do it. Yeah. I have no idea.
I don't know, but I was just like, that's too late for me. But his mom, like, there's been, like, interviews ever since he's died, and his mom's been interviewed, and his mom said that he drank kerosene as a child.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he got a hold of some kerosene, and the doctor said he would never be the same. So with a lot of serial killers that I've listened to, they have a lot of head injuries, or they bang their head, or something like that. So, I mean, maybe kerosene could do brain damage. I mean, that's a solid theory.
Yeah. I mean, I've never heard of anyone drinking kerosene.
I haven't either, but.
That is crazy.
Yeah. So he drank some kerosene and it fucked him up a little bit. But in total, Gaskin said he killed 80 to 90, but then he finally said 105. However, there's no physical evidence of that many. So it could have been like trying to get out of the electric chair.
Well, and men tend to over-exaggerate.
Do they? Okay, we all know that. So there's evidence of 13 people that he killed total in the grave in the swamp. And I thought this was kind of interesting. There wasn't a lot of details on it. But one of the victims that it was proven that he killed was a senator's daughter.
Wow.
And yeah, so his daughter, he had a daughter apparently with one of his random like sadistic hookups that he was doing. But his daughter to this day says it was 105 because she knew when daddy was lying.
Oh, wow. That's sad. And I was like, that's really sad.
I was like, oh, you're still believing that?
Yeah.
But he's the biggest killer, serial killer in South Carolina ever. And there is a book called Final Truth on Amazon. And I was going to buy it and read it for this podcast. But it is $500.
Yeah, no, that's not worth it.
I'm not spending almost my whole stimulus check on it.
Nope, not worth it at all.
So it's apparently full of contradictions. He said that if they want a juicy book, I'll give him one.
Right.
And he also called himself a vampire that had to kill after a certain amount of time. So we may never know the true number of people.
Well, that's a crazy story.
And that is the story of Donald Gaskin.
That's ridiculous. I'm so surprised that he's not more widely known.
I just don't know how we've never heard of him.
No, that's crazy.
Yeah.
Wow.
My brain was like on a roller coaster of down.
Yeah, I don't even know how to feel right now besides pouring another drink.
I think that we should 100% pour another drink.
Well, we appreciate everyone listening. Mom, Dad, Katie, Nash, Cisco, all of our friends, and hopefully some other people. And we will catch you guys next time. And we're going to post all of our sources in the show notes just so you guys can see them and so you know that we're not plagiarizing. And we will see you next week.
See you next week, guys. Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you.
Love you.
Bye. Hey, Jen here. So in order to complete my research for this episode, I used the following sources. So if you want more information, please feel free to reach out to us on our Instagram
or just listen here and I'm going to tell you all the sources that I use in order to get my information. There's a podcast called Cults, and it's from the Parcast Network. It is amazing. They do an amazing job. If you ever really want to do a deep dive into the psychology of cults, they are amazing. And they have an episode titled The Family, and I listened to that while preparing for this. I also watched a documentary off of Amazon Prime called The Cult of the Family. You have to have a Starz subscription in order to watch it, but I just did the free 7-day trial and I was able to watch it, and it was really, really helpful. They interview a ton of the survivors, and it was a super interesting documentary, so I suggest that everyone should listen to it. I also found articles on the internet from The Guardian about Anne Hamilton Byrne, how she died. I also read articles on BBC News about the Australian cult, the family leader, and Hamilton Byrne. I found more information on 9news.com about Anne Hamilton Byrne. Former detective reveals why the infamous cult never saw jail time. Also, I had information on mamamia.com, and it was a news article about the family cult. Why did Anne Hamilton Byrne start the cult? CBS News also had information on Children of the Cult, Inside the Family, the Australian cult led by Anne Hamilton Byrne. There is an article by Rolling Stones called Australian Cults, The Grim, the Bad, and the Ugly, The Family, that I thought was super helpful. I also went to the website from the documentary, and you can find that on thefamilysect.com. They had tons of information about this sect. And last but not least, I also used Urban Dictionary in order to get the definitions and the Webster Dictionary. So like I said, if there's any questions about where this information came from, just please reach out to us on the Instagram, and I'd be more than happy to send you all of the links to the research. Thanks, guys, and have a great week.
Hey, guys, Vanessa here, and I just wanted to tell you about my sources for the first episode. I found out about Donald Gaskins on Murderpedia. It is a free online encyclopedia of murderers and the largest database of serial killers and mass murderers around the world. I also used crimemuseum.org as a source. It gave a great background into Donald's history and how he grew up and his jail time and everything like that. And then I also watched a documentary on YouTube, and it's called Born to Kill. It had interviews with his family members, some of the officers that worked on the case. It was really interesting to watch, and it was only about an hour long, so that helped me a lot as well. And just to let you guys know, for this podcast, we are absolutely not making fun of serial killers. We're not making fun of cults. These are very serious matters. There were real victims in these cases. We just try to lighten the mood and make these hard crimes a little bit easier to listen to. We just wanted to let you guys know that, so there's absolutely no disrespect. Again, please follow us on Instagram. The handle is Cults, Killers, and Cocktails. And we will see you all next week. Thank you so much again for listening. Bye.